And welcome back to another episode, another week indeed of the Damage Report. It's Monday and it's already looking like it's going to be fantastic. Francesca Fiorentini, how's it going?
Buongiorno, tutti sta prendido frego. I don't know what I'm saying, but I tried to. Anyway, I don't speak Italian. Good morning, what's going on? Happy Monday.
You don't speak much of it, although you are Italian. I found out this morning that your birth name was Giuseppe.
Oh, Giuseppe, so Fiorentini. Cool. Yeah, I changed it to Francesca. It's easier than Giuseppe.
Yeah. It's probably a good call. Look, we have a lot of news that we're gonna talk about and we're gonna get to that. I'm just gonna quickly say, just because you know everything's falling apart, I'm not gonna pretend that it's not. I don't know what the minutes leading up to Anderson Cooper are like, or what Don Lemon is doing 3 minutes out. But man, it's weird here. I'm spilling coffee all over the studio by myself. We're talking about stuff that probably they're not on Cuomo.
They definitely are. I think it's whatever you're doing, they're doing 10 times worse. They're just, you remember Lawrence O'Donnell yelling, "Stop the hammering." It's just that. It's just a lot of ego.
I vaguely do. Yeah.
It's a lot of yelling at producers.
Yeah, that's true. I try not to do that. Although maybe it's fun. Maybe I should try. Okay, so very glad to have you here because we are entering into the 2 weeks before election week. And I don't know what to do or say because it's so big and there's so much riding on it. And I know that there's things that because of the platform that we have, and obviously we have people, both of us, that care about what we think, like we gotta do right by them in this last critical period leading up to what could become one of the most monumentous political weeks of our lives. I don't know what I'm supposed to do, Francesca. Perhaps we can figure something out. I know we're gonna be talking about California ballot initiatives at some point later on this week. I'm hoping to get Anna on. I was gonna do it with Brett, but I think that we would disagree too much and I just can't take that right now. I don't wanna know which way we
get like a long argument about stem cell.
I don't know. I don't wanna do it. But anyway, I know you just had your show last night, the Bituation Room. Yes. 2 weeks out from the election, what's the Bituation Room about?
Bituation Room is always about laughing in end times. So definitely trying to find some humor in all of this, but also some political strategy. So we had organizer Joshua Kahn Russell on, who's working with Choose Democracy, which is one of the many organizations that's trying to game out what if Trump doesn't leave office and what would that require of us? What would that require of us in our roles as whatever we are, whether we're teachers or bus drivers or tech workers or whatever our chosen profession is, mothers, fathers, like we will need a massive amount of resistance and we will need to deny the legitimacy of whatever the coup plotters are claiming. Yeah. And this is the moment we're in. So it's kind of like it's time to not be so Pollyanna with America's a great democracy and oh, we'll pull through. Like we know after 4 years of watching the Democrats try to rein this president in and the Republicans going along with whatever he does, that we can't count on our politicians anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And we really need to get past this like weird obsession with like being great and we're great or unprecedented. I'm not interested in any of that. Here's what America is, all I've got. So I'm gonna make it as good as I can. I don't care what it is or what it was. I care about what it hypothetically could be, although that's a shifting target. But anyway, we do have news that we have to get to. Obviously, thank you to everybody who's already joining us, whether you're on Twitch or YouTube or other platforms I may not even know about. Thank you for being there. You can chat with us, you can send us super chats and things like that. We'll respond as we go along. Please hit the like button and share the stream if you haven't already. Oh, and by the way, not only do we have an Instagram where you'd find out about the thing I'm just about to say, Instagram.com/TheDamageReport. Many of you were very enthusiastic about the launch of the first two t-shirt designs for The Damage Report. And I've now got my first one in person. This is the first Ooh. Ever Damage Report shirt available now. Will it be available next week? Probably, but not forever. And this is a piece of history, as well as the first Dragon Squad shirt. I'll be wearing that tomorrow, which I love. Francesca, you had predictions about what effect it could have on people's social lives. I think it's moving things up. I feel like a more confident me in the dragon shirt.
Yeah.
Maybe that says more about me than the shirt. I don't know.
I love them both. I take back whatever I said. If you know, you know, and it's great. Someone will recognize and be like, And that's, exactly. We all love that moment.
Exactly, exactly. Imagine the first time you see someone else in the wild from Dragon Squad. Anyway, with that, let's get into the news because there's so much that we gotta talk about. And some of it is unfortunate, but it's sort of our job, so we're gonna do it. There have already been a few October surprises. The big one that was planned by Donald Trump's extended goon squad was the Hunter Biden thing. And that thing is a lot of different things. Nobody really seems to know, but the New York Post was sure that it was something. And so they took this story given to them literally by Rudy Giuliani and Steve Bannon and just said, let's run with it. And it turns out that might not have been the best choice because follow-up reporting of the process that eventually resulted in this big New York Times Hunter Biden thing is showing that there might have been a few problems with it. So let's go through a little bit of what was sort of an issue with that story's publication. The New York Post's front page article about Hunter Biden last Wednesday was written mostly by a staff reporter who it turns out refused to put his own name on it, according to two New York Post employees. This is Bruce Golding, a reporter that's been there since 2007, didn't allow his byline to be used because he had concerns over the article's credibility. Remember, the article he had just written, and by the way, all of these sources are anonymous because they're worried about retaliation, which they definitely should be. So the article suggested that Joe Biden had used his position to enrich his son Hunter when he was vice president. The Post based the story on photos and documents the paper said was taken from the hard drive of a laptop reportedly belonging to Hunter Biden. And if you haven't been following this, that's good for your sanity. Effectively, the story is that Hunter Biden apparently decided to go to a tiny little laptop repair store that isn't anywhere near where he lives. And he gave them a laptop with a bunch of sensitive material on it and then just never went back and got it again. Maybe that's a thing. There's other issues, but Francesca, this is the first that we're talking about this story on the channel. We're gonna go to some more of the credibility issues, but what's your thinking about this so far?
I mean, this story broke, I believe, on the same night and the same day of the dueling town halls. And I saw some mainstream outlets like MSNBC try to make it an issue. And immediately the first line is found in pawn shop left by Hunter Biden. And you're like, okay, this is fake. Like, what is this? What? And even if it were real, it definitely wasn't found in a pawn shop. So my initial reaction was, are we really doing this again? Like, are we actually going to uncritically accept some random ridiculous story about yet more hacked emails, right? Like, okay, here we go, like clockwork. So I was really disappointed in it. And I'm happy now that we're learning a little bit more of the context about how it came about.
Yeah, exactly. And look, you've already given the, I guess the caveat, I'll give the caveat too. If it's real, here's the thing. Like the WikiLeaks emails back in 2016 were real. As far as we know, every single one of them was authentic. Hypothetically, something could come out of them that would be really devastating. But we do need to understand the meta media narrative of there being a lot of a thing that you keep rolling out a little bit at a time of, which, and remember, like, I haven't said anything about the substance of whatever the hypothetical I'm talking about is, but doesn't it seem like there's something? There's a lot of it. And now there's a little bit more coming out. And that's what happened with WikiLeaks. You know, people rolled out one email a day for literally months, got a bunch of like views and Fox News loved it. So that's happening now for this too, with Fox News like taking each of the individual new emails that come out that like are like text conversations between Hunter and Joe where Joe says that he loves him or something. And it's very scandalous,
like really,
and it's very shocking.
That are like really moving, like Hunter Biden texting his dad from rehab being like, I've ruined your campaign, I'm so sorry. This is obviously like a year ago. And then his dad just waking up being like, good morning, son, I love you. And I miss you a lot. You know, like, oh my God, this is supposed to be damning to Joe Biden. Okay, because I think it somehow makes me like him, and I'm totally not that person to fall for the decency thing. But anyway, it makes me like, oh God, Dad, you know, Dad.
I think that some people feel freed up to want to pretend that there's more than there isn't, because hey, it's okay to attack Joe because he's up by so much. Or like, oh God, like we've been so critical of Trump, we gotta find something to be critical. Here's the thing, there's well-established historical things about Joe Biden have a problem with that we've talked about literally ad nauseum. We're not under any sort of obligation to pretend that nonsense is more serious than it is. Like, if you want to zoom out 500 miles, do I think that Joe Biden has done things to benefit his family? Probably. I assume all of them do because they're politicians. They're not my buddy. I don't play Fortnite with them. We don't have that sort of relationship. I'm very critical of them, but also understand that this isn't the first pass we're taking at the Ukraine thing. There's been any number of different Senate investigations and House investigations and all that stuff. Honestly, I don't know how they haven't found more because there's got to be something there. But what I don't think is there is probably anything found in a blind guy's pawn shop. It just doesn't make sense. And it's going to make even less sense as we go through a bit more of the caveats. But before we do that, anything more on this?
I mean, I think once again, we have to, from as progressives, as people on the left, remember the moment that we're in, remember the stakes, and also remember, like, let's not wake up and do what mainstream media does and wake up sort of a fresh little baby every day that's forgotten everything and has forgotten that this president was impeached for trying to solicit Ukraine by withholding funds, right? Like to that country to be like, no, give me a little bit more on Hunter Biden. Like, are we that dumb that now, you know, 7 months later, when like somehow miraculously a pawn shop has found a few emails, we'll be like, oh, there it was. And it's like, no, y'all, like let's remember what's going on. Let's remember the reality here.
Well, that seems reasonable, but the whole Ukraine thing was a long time ago. What the Democrats should have done is really drive it into people's consciousness, like by maybe impeaching the president over literally this thing. But no, still people can't remember it.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Okay, more on issues with the New York Post's reporting. So this is according to New York Times reporting. Many Post staff members questioned whether the paper had done enough to verify the authenticity of the hard drive's contents. This is according to five people with knowledge of the tabloid's inner workings. I love the New York Times just calls it a tabloid there. That's funny. Staff members also had concerns about the reliability of its sources and its timing. Okay, so timing is 2.5 weeks out from an election. That seems like kind of an issue. Sources, Steve Bannon, Rudy Giuliani. Which is worse? That the one guy facing federal charges and who's a white nationalist goon, or the big drunk who might or might not literally be a vampire? I don't know, but those are among the two less credible sources. Rudy Giuliani's two Ukrainian friends I would trust more.
I'm going with vampire drunk on that, right? Like,
I would
if you
Bannon
had to pick.
What? I think I'd trust Bannon more.
No. There's too much riding. There's too much in it for Bannon. But like vampire drunk just like wants to get, you know, effed up and like hang upside down. Like hang upside down and like do a kegger. Like that dude has less to like, there's fewer stakes, you know what I'm saying? So I'm going with vampire drunk on this. But poll, I'm gonna poll in the chat. One.
Let's do that. Who do you trust more?
One for Bannon, two for Giuliani. white supremacist under federal indictment, vampire drunk number two.
Okay, there is nothing I love more than the fact that you are not only calling for a poll, but you did it the way we do it, the ones and twos. I love it.
I know.
Let's see what we got.
It's like I do okay, this I'm show seeing, every Monday.
You do. I'm seeing some threes and fours. What the hell, people? What the hell? Two is Giuliani, right?
Yeah.
I think three is beating one, let alone two. Two is definitely beating one. I see a couple ones. Okay, I've been overruled. Okay, people trust the guy who can't go into the sun more than the guy who looks like he like floated for weeks on a raft in the Pacific Ocean. But anyway, there are other problems with this story. So here we go. Listen to Giuliani. Mr. Giuliani said he chose the post because, quote, either nobody else would take it, or if they took it, they would spend all the time they could to try to contradict it before they put it out. Which is a funny way to say, check if it's true. Anyway, so that's sort of giving the game away. As the deadline approached, editors pressed staff members to add their bylines to the story. Let's pause there for a second. We'll come back to that graphic in a second. If the editors are having to try to push people into putting their names on a story, maybe the story's not credible. Maybe it's not. Anyway, and at least one, aside from Mr. Golding, refused. So Mr. Golding is the one who actually wrote it. He refused to have his name on it. Someone else refused. A Post spokeswoman had no comment on how the article was written or edited, although we already understand quite a bit of it. Now, it did in the end have two bylines. The article appeared Wednesday with two. Emma Jo Morris, a deputy politics editor who joined the paper after 4 years at Fox News. Ms. Morris did not have a bylined article in the Post before Wednesday. That was her first one.
Wow.
She arrived at the Post in April after working as an associate producer on Sean Hannity's Fox News show, according to a LinkedIn profile. Her Instagram account, which was set to private on Wednesday, and here's why, included photos of her posing with the former Trump administration members, Mr. Bannon and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, as well as Roger Stone Jr., a friend and former campaign advisor to Mr. Trump. So two names. The first one literally just stopped working at Fox News for Sean Hannity, an unofficial advisor to the Trump campaign, and routinely parties with Steve Bannon and Roger Stone. The other name, Gabrielle Fonrouge, found out her byline was on the story only after it was published.
Jesus. I mean, just generally, if for those journalists there, people know how journalism sort of works. Usually when you work on a story, you want your name on it. You're proud of it. Hey, if it is, you know, a true story, if it really is credible, if it has potential to shape the election and inform the American public, you'd want your name on that, right? I mean, yeah. In 2016, people jumped over themselves to put their name on things. It didn't matter really what it was about. I mean, it was, but like, I don't, again, part of me is like, is this because they don't want to face the backlash? No, it's not. It's because the only person who did want their name on is totally part of the Trump clique. And the poor other person didn't know until they saw the actual article printed. I mean, it's thin, it's paper thin, and it's ridiculous. And I'm sad actually that some journalists sort of started to fall for it last week. And yeah. I'm glad they kind of pulled back from the brink. Because again, we could have been in another sort of Comey-esque Hillary's email situation.
And that is the perfect example. I have been so worried that the media is going to be like, because most of the media doesn't like Trump. Obviously, we get that. But we also know who they are, that they're going to be watching week after week as the polls are still consistent with Biden having a lead. And they're going to be like, I needs me some drama. There's got to be something. I want to show how objective I am. But thankfully, they haven't totally gone in for it yet. There's still time. And they're definitely going to have a day or two of going in for it when Trump announces next Wednesday that there's a vaccine that's imminently available. So get ready for that. That's going to be fun. But anyway, yeah, thankfully, people other than the New York Post, people are approaching this with quite a bit of skepticism, which is deserved, considering the timing, the sources, and also factoring in the stakes. In the weeks leading up to the election, we not only have election related news about Hunter Biden coming out in the New York Post, but we also have just Pizzagate 2.0 effectively. I saw this tweet from Ben Collins who says, there's a straight up plagiarized Pizzagate rumor going around Twitter tonight. It's incredibly specific and they just replaced Hillary Clinton with Hunter Biden, literally no variation. That's not the issue. The issue is the second part of the tweet, 14,000 retweets in less than 2 hours. They're just running it back, no changes from 2016. And I will say, I'm gonna show you a tweet. I don't know if this is the one he's talking about, but I hope that it is because otherwise there's two of them. So Wayne Allen Root got over 20,000 retweets saying, breaking news, my sources, as high up as it gets, watched videos on Hunter's laptops today. Just told me point blank, no rumor, they saw Hunter raping and torturing little Chinese children. Chinese government has the same videos, Biden is compromised, blackmailed, can never be prez. And that was just retweeted and retweeted and retweeted and Twitter's apparently fine with it. God only knows how much spread this sort of thing is getting on Facebook. This is just the same things they said about Hillary Clinton. They're just changing the name. But despite the supposed newfound worry about misinformation on these social media platforms, that tweet has more retweets than anything I've ever said. And it's 100% just made up by this madman.
Oh, God. I mean, first of all, when you have bots, they let you do anything. And we've seen the ways that bots, you know, there are mappings of the way bot clouds and like are able to amplify this kind of stuff. And so there's bots and then there's idiots, and we know that fake news rises faster. Can I just say, like, the words raping and torturing Chinese children is in and of itself incredibly offensive. And just by saying that, it's like a little bit of a suggestion that that person making up that lie kind of likes that. You know, this obsession with pedophilia that QAnon and like the extreme right and these conspiracy theorists have, like, that really reflects more on them and their interests than it does on anything that's happening in reality. They're not talking about actual sex trafficking of minors. They're not talking about the scandals in churches and, you know, dioceses around the world. No, they're not talking about the stuff that we know about. They're not talking about Jeffrey Epstein. But then you want to just say, like, raping and torturing Chinese children, like, you're yeah, sick. I'm sorry. Like, that stuff is sick to me. Like, why are you amplifying that stuff? Why are you even saying it? You don't even put it in quotes. You don't even, like, or you, I mean, it is. It's incredibly offensive, I think. I don't know. Am I wrong to be offended?
No, I read all, like, the hyper focus on pedophilia to me reads like it seems like either projection or, like, honestly, and I've said this before in the show, if you can believe, if you can come to the point where you believe that the vast majority of people are secretly either raping children or want to rape children, that does say something about you, because it don't does. Think people want that. I think that's a really bizarre thing to want. But some people believe, oh yeah, no, everybody wants to rape children. I don't think so. I think that you're revealing something. Now, there's some people who are just, you know, like some random suburban mom who's like, protect the kids at all costs. Okay, maybe you're afraid of everything. I get it. That's fine. Still, do you trust Wayne Allen Root? Look, that tweet, who cares? But you're gonna see more and more of this. And some of it is going to be a rando on Twitter. Some of it is gonna make it to Fox News. And so everybody needs to be on extra guard over the next few weeks against crazy nonsense intended to swing the election. I'm gonna do my best. I know Francesca will, but everybody needs to be ready for this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you really can't make it up. We knew 2020 was gonna be bad. And just imagine our little 2016 selves being like, oh wow, 2020 is gonna really be bad when it comes to, like, fake news and any kind of, you know, information warfare, blah, 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 blah. And we did not see a pandemic coming at all, right? We did not see RBG dying. I mean, we did, really, let's be real, but we didn't see it happening now. So it's like, let's just, you know, take a deep breath, remember sort of where we're at, our priorities. Obviously, you know, again, reach out to the Karens and the Kevins in your life. If you need to reel people in from the brink, contact that QAnon cousin, do what you can, let it be, don't, you know, but like, breathe deep, you know, and because we got to tuck in for a long winter.
Yeah, 100%. It's gonna be a rough one. Remember, even if Biden wins, even if Trump goes, we have months of unleashed Trump, who is not accountable to anything. Dr. Fauci was just on a 60 Minutes, and we're getting a few little videos out of it of him confirming a little bit of what we've heard behind the scenes, including this first section where he talks about the White House attempt to sort of corral his exposure to the media.
During this pandemic, has the White House been controlling when you can speak with the media?
You know, I think you'd have to be honest to say yes. I certainly have not been allowed to go on many, many, many shows that have asked for me.
One of the most trusted voices in America, and yet you're not there. You're not allowed to talk with us. So can you understand the frustration that maybe there's been a restriction on the flow of information and on transparency?
You know, I think there has been a restriction, John, but it doesn't... It isn't consistent.
We've heard from reporters saying that they haven't been able to book him in the past, and he's there confirming that that is a thing. So Francesca, I guess we've already known about this, but it is pretty significant that the most trusted Trump administration officials during an ongoing pandemic is being blocked from appearing on the media, as Trump is himself using supposedly Fauci's endorsement of him in campaign ads.
I mean, I think this is, it's great to hear him say it out loud. I'm not discounting that, but I also think Fauci's still hedging here. I mean, I think somehow he's still afraid that he will be even further sidelined, which, you know, if you think about, you know, the possibility that Trump could win re-election is not a bad place to be. It's just scary. Like, I think we've all seen interviews with Fauci where he won't completely 180 criticize the president. I think in the hearings where he's sort of grilled by lawmakers, he'll be a little bit more honest. But even in those appearances, he's not trying to discredit this administration completely. He's trying to actually utilize his appearances to make sure that, you know, that Trump actually is still listening to him and like knows that he's in this, right? He wants actually to turn this thing around. But what I'm saying is it's scary is that it's very authoritarian type behavior when you are interviewed and asked point blank and you're like, yeah, I've been somewhat restricted. I don't think it's been full access to me. He's not openly saying, yeah, no, they tell me that I can't. You know, like, so even just watching him tiptoe is very concerning.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, to the director, just the way the conversation is going, can we skip to the third video in a second? We'll go back to the second after, but the third video about the Trump ad. Yeah, I get a little bit of the hedge too, but we've got a bit here that he's still somewhat hedging, but he's being willing to admit things about Trump that I'm a little bit surprised by. So let's go to that video where he talks a little bit more about being put non-consensually into these Trump ads.
Earlier this month, the Trump campaign released this television ad. It features what appears to be a glowing remark from Dr. Fauci on President Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic.
I can't imagine that anybody could be doing more.
Stunning.
Fauci says his words were taken out of context. But this week, the ad continued to run in key battleground states.
I do not, and nor will I ever, publicly endorse any political candidate. And here I am, they sticking me right in the middle of a campaign ad, which I thought was outrageous. I was referring to something entirely different. I was referring to the grueling work of the task force that, God, we were knocking ourselves out 7 days a week. I don't think we could possibly have done any more than that.
Did the steam start to come out of your ears?
No, it did. Quite frankly, I got really ticked off.
It has to be a cartoon image. Anyway, so there, he's continuing to talk about the fact that Trump shouldn't have used him in the ad. That's not direct criticism of Trump's leadership or lack of leadership during the pandemic. But considering that the possibility that Trump could strike back against him, it's at least somewhat criticism. And we'll have more in a minute.
Absolutely. No, and he should be mad. Ticked off. I was really ticked off. I like Fauci, let's be real. Like, I'm not saying he should. I just think it's a really hard dance with this administration. I think he's done more than most. We know he's done more than Dr. Birx has. And he's also been summarily sidelined for that. I don't really know what else there is to lose. I mean, part of me is like, why wouldn't Fauci just do some like weekly Zoom meetings with the press, you know, like, or daily Zoom briefings, you know, just like, let's just do this. Let's talk about this. I think there's way more to know in terms of how the coronavirus task force did or did not unfold. And I hope that come November, he can feel free to explain what had happened and also be able to shape and continue shaping our country's response, since we don't have this pandemic nearly under control.
Yeah, especially because it doesn't seem impossible that Biden would keep Fauci on. I don't know why he wouldn't.
Why wouldn't he? Yeah.
It would feel a little bit like, it would feel like a little bit like Bob Woodward. Like, dude, you have an opportunity. People trust you. I don't know if undecided voters are particularly going to be swayed by him, but like if there is more that you know, how are you not coming out with it a couple weeks from the election, knowing what the stakes are in terms of the two different paths we could take in terms of the pandemic going forward, depending on who wins? I mean, the sheer number of lives that are at stake, it's at least tens of thousands, if not hundreds long term. I feel like he could be more forthright. I want to start off with a little bit of, I guess, breaking news from this morning with Caitlin Collins, who was apparently getting information from a Trump campaign call that was happening this morning. There was a lot of interesting stuff in there. But one interesting thing was she says on call with campaign staff, President Trump says people are tired of hearing about coronavirus. Quote,
people are saying whatever, just leave us alone. They're tired of it. People are tired of hearing Fauci and all these idiots. Fauci's a nice guy. He's been here for 500 years.
It felt like a correction. I don't know for sure. I don't have the audio, but it felt like, oh God, did I just say he's an idiot? And so he called them idiots. Remember, this is the same Trump who just over the weekend said that if Joe Biden gets elected, he's going to listen to the scientists. Ooh, sends a chill down your spine. And so there, he's talking about Fauci and all of these idiots. Nobody wants to hear from them. That's Trump's normal like projection. He doesn't want to hear from him. He hates how popular science is, let alone Fauci. And so there he's lashing out at him on a call that he had already in the call said, if there are any reporters, I don't care, I'm telling it like it is. Like he knew there were people listening and he still was willing to attack Fauci like that.
And that's the thing, which is like, you know, Fauci has been hedging a little bit and trying to sort of protect his status while being critical and honest. And let's say Trump does win re-election. Do you think Trump is gonna reward Fauci for hedging and continue to keep him on? No. They're going to quadruple down on herd immunity, which is now their strategy, right? Which is infecting however many millions of us. And bye-bye Fauci. So like, you know, I get, of course, he would not want to be part of a campaign ad, but it's also a little bit like, homie, like you realize there is only one choice for you and science and all of us surviving this, right? You know, or like. And that is Biden winning. Let's just be honest. So,
let's go with a bit of that.
Yeah.
Because like we've been talking about the stakes for Fauci. If Trump wins, doesn't he fire Fauci? Like it feels like he hasn't fired him because it would look bad leading up to the election. So you think definitely? You know what? Let's poll it.
He's fine. Fire.
If you think he's gonna fire, keep on. If you think he's gonna keep on, no. I feel like he's gonna fire him. They'll come up with some BS excuse, something Fauci said that he didn't like, but they're gonna fire him because they don't care. They've got Scott Atlas, they've got the pseudo intellectual cover for their implicit herd immunity strategy.
Scott Atlas shrugged. Yes, Dr. Fauci was very unfair to Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election and mishandled her emails and whoop. Yeah, no, I've already said that. Okay, well, it doesn't matter. You know, like that's, it'll be that, it'll just be that.
Yeah, 100%. Oh my God, I can't believe that was actually the argument about Comey. What a ridiculous sham in a period of ridiculous shams. Okay, so that was Trump this morning attacking him. I want to give you a little bit more from 60 Minutes because Dr. Fauci was also asked about the event that Donald Trump held, the fact that he ended up getting coronavirus. Let's go to that.
Were you surprised that President Trump got sick?
Absolutely not. I was worried that he was going to get sick when I saw him in a completely precarious situation of crowded, no separation between people, and almost nobody wearing a mask. When I saw that on TV, I said, oh my goodness, nothing good can come out of that. That's gotta be a problem. And then sure enough, it turned out to be a super spreader event.
He looks so small and cute. Anyway, it's just funny. He's such a small little guy. Anyway, yeah, no, he's right. Yeah, It was obvious that Trump was inevitably going to get it. I assumed we would never find out. And remember, that was initially their plan, was to not reveal it in the first 24 hours or so. And they've certainly continued to hide information about exactly how it all played out.
Yeah, notice how we're not talking about it. I'm sorry. Like, the media clearly. What?
Well, I just was. But you're right.
No, yeah, no. But no, I mean, you're right in terms of like, it's nice that Fauci's bringing this super spreader up again, a super spreader event up again. And obviously he's, I mean, I'm just like, are we all just forgetting that half the Trump administration got COVID and he himself may still have COVID? Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Cool. Moving on. Yeah. Oh, another debate. Tight. Yeah. How? In what world? In only in this ridiculous election world that America is forced into every 4 years would this even be real? Like, it's just bad. It's all bad. And I want to know how Stephen Miller is doing. How's he doing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess fine. I guess they all got through it because again, they got the super secret. They pulled out of the vault. There was this thing they had to pull up and then steam came out and it was their secret monkey medicine and they got it and we're not gonna. That's just the way it works. They got Chris Christie through this thing. They should be able to save everyone. And I can say from my own family's experience, they weren't able to. They're getting special treatment. I'm joking about the monkey medicine, but it's special stuff that not everybody has access to. Anyway, yeah, so look, Trump's not gonna like that. Him saying, of course, you know, he wasn't surprised that he got it, but yeah, who would? Like Trump is the guy who's going with Scott Atlas because he saw him on Fox News.
Yeah, and on that, John, on that, reporters need to be asking if anyone who recovered who was sick in the Trump administration, how did you recover? What was that monkey medicine? Let us know. Seriously. What was your regimen? Okay, did you pay for that healthcare? Tell us, we want to know. This is not over just because you're over the virus or the virus apparently has left your body, i.e. you're so jacked on steroids. Like, again, I know this is not the conversation, but like, we should absolutely be asking those questions. Yeah. Fauci unleashed, baby. I want to see more of this.
Exactly. You know what? I really want to show the death threats to the director. If we could jump to the last Fauci video, just because it's on this being willing to criticize him. Like, just such an indictment of Trump's entire view of public health and masculinity and everything. Here's a last little bit from 60 Minutes with Dr. Fauci.
At all ironic that the president, who has not always consistently followed the advice of public health officials and scientists, seems to have been made better by science.
Well, I don't think it's ironic. I think it's fortunate that the president of the United States benefited from science. You know, I think deep down he believes in science. If he didn't, he would not have entrusted his health to the very competent physicians at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center.
But at the same time, he hasn't worn masks consistently. Yeah, he's pushed back against things you've said.
See, I think that's less an anti-science than it's more a statement.
What kind of a statement?
You know, a statement of strength, like we're strong, we don't need a mask, that kind of thing.
You know,
he sometimes equates wearing a mask with weakness.
Yeah, that means that you are weak because you're stupid and you can't be strong if you're stupid. That's my view. And he just admitted that. Again, it's another thing that, you know, he could be far more critical of Donald Trump. And by he could, I mean, there's room for it. And also, I'm sure he could. I'm sure he's got the information from those meetings and all that. He could talk about Trump talking about herd immunity. Like, he could really drive home how little Trump cared if millions of people died. And he's not doing that, but he is being critical of Trump, his worldview, the way he sees strength and all of that. I don't think that Donald Trump is gonna like that if when the full thing comes out, it's as critical.
Yeah, I mean, I think back to your point about Bob Woodward and sort of withholding information if you have it, and you know, or even back to 2016, you know, sort of the ways that the Trump campaign was compromised, by Russia, but Obama didn't want to sway the election, so he kept it to himself. We're kind of in that moment now, where I think the pandemic and Trump's response to it is affecting voters, right? Perhaps more than any other issue this election cycle. And to say that, well, he doesn't want to appear weak. Well, Trump says that openly too. What's actually happening is he's deliberately misleading Americans and he's deliberately misleading his followers. And he's doing this on purpose to score political points when they have nothing to do with science. And yeah. And so why don't you say that, Dr. Fauci, right? It's like he said, well, I think he believes in science. Oh, okay. Because if he didn't, he wouldn't have let all these doctors work on him and suggest all these, you know, therapeutic treatments for him. So, let's dig into that a little bit more. When else has he said that he believes in science, but he can't openly say he believes in science? Does he think you're real, Dr. Fauci? Or are you just a figment of his imagination? Like, when do you exist and when do you not?
Mm-hmm. That's good. I would watch a few minutes of that. Maybe not 60, but I'd watch a few. Oh, Mark Zuckerberg, you slimy little thing. So, look. Mark Zuckerberg has given a lot of assurances about Facebook's commitment to objectivity, them caring about facts, but not being willing to fact check political ads. It's confusing. And I think it's intentionally confusing because the more we find out from Facebook employees, the more we find out that Mark Zuckerberg, a guy who routinely dines with right wingers and seems to give massive preferential treatment in his own personal life to right wing media outlets and figures, over the left, turns out behind the scenes is kind of doing the same thing. So take a look at this amazing reporting. When Facebook tweaked its newsfeed algorithm back in 2017 to reduce the visibility of political news, the company's engineers intentionally designed the system to disproportionately impact left-leaning outlets, effectively choking off their traffic in the process. According to a Wall Street Journal report this week, Facebook bigwigs at the time were concerned about how these changes would affect right-leaning news outlets and wanted to avoid adding fuel to critics' arguments that the platform had an anti-conservative bias. So what did they do? They just biased it in the opposite direction. They evidently overcorrected. Facebook's engineers overhauled the update to affect left-leaning sites more than previously planned, and Mark Zuckerberg himself okayed the redesign, according to sources that talked to the journal. The changes weren't aimed at any particular outlet, just apparently at the left. And so one of the sites the report cited as being negatively affected by this redesign was Mother Jones, a renowned investigative news outlet. In response to the journal's expose, Mother Jones editorial director for growth and strategy, Ben Dreyfus, wrote a scathing critique of Facebook that details years of frustrating and strained relationships with the company. He said that in multiple meetings with Facebook execs back in 2017 and 2018, he was assured that while publishers could expect traffic to lag after the algorithmic changes, it was, quote, not in a way that favored or disfavored any single publication or class of publisher, which I guess is technically true, but it definitely was affecting a sort of publisher, not just a class, though. They were doing what the right wanted them to do. The right whines and cries about being biased against. And so Facebook just instead strikes out at the left to make the right feel better because the right whines way more than the left does. And apparently for years now, it has been affecting left-leaning news sites on Facebook. Francesca.
Yeah, I mean, I have personal experience with this with my work at AJ Plus, which began around, it began around 2013, but we really surged in the following years as Facebook was rolling out all their video. And 2017 was a complete and utter drop off. And AJ Plus is absolutely left leaning. I mean, we cover issues that affect people of color, indigenous people, women, like LGBTQ community. That's supposedly left. International news, etc. So I've seen the numbers, I've seen them myself, like day to, you know, one day to the next completely change. Facebook is incredibly opaque with their algorithm. And here's the thing, I'm tired of this being framed as, oops, we didn't know it was going to do that. No, they said it, they've said it for everything now. They've used this excuse. Oops, when we removed fact checkers, we didn't know it was gonna lift up fake news. Oops, when we changed our algorithm, we didn't really know it was gonna affect, you know, left-leaning sites more than right. Well, we did actually wanna affect left-leaning sites, but not to the degree that we did. No. All of this was absolutely on purpose. Whether or not it was the right that whined, it's the ears of Mark Zuckerberg that listened. It's the little bug-eyed Ben Shapiro worshiping weirdo bangs, alien-like form, who stole an idea in order to rank women and then became a multi-billionaire that absolutely is swaying Facebook in the conservative favor because that's what he believes himself. So yeah. let's take off the rose-colored glasses and let's be real. Mother Jones. Like AJ Plus and News Broke is one thing because like, you know, I'm biased, but it's all fact-based bias. That's what I say, fact-based bias. But Mother Jones is an investigative news outlet. What does that mean? It means you spend months reporting on one issue, digging deep, fact checking your sources, unlike the New York Post, right? And then you put out an expose or you put out a long series of articles. You have journalists who are covering an issue, you know, for years. Oh yeah, that's left-leaning. Doing investigative journalism is somehow left-leaning. Get out of here. I'm so done. So done with their excuses. They don't deserve our business.
Yeah, I agree. And you can see the effect of this. Just check the daily posts on Twitter of the top 10 trending, you know, where were the top 10 trending stories or posts on Facebook every day. And it's going to be, maybe you'll get a CNN or something, but the rest are going to be Ben Shapiro and Dan Bongino and Donald Trump and all of that. And it's not because, you know, there's a lot more conservatives than there are liberals. There aren't. The numbers clearly show that. Yes, conservatives appear to spend the vast majority of their time on Facebook all day long, so that helps. And it certainly doesn't hurt that Mother Jones will do months to produce an article, whereas these ghouls just make up like lies that make people angry. Like that's, they just come up with, like Dan Bongino will just do a post about, yeah, Biden just said in an interview that he's going to, if he loses, he's going to invade the White House or something. No, it's not true, but it gets conservative fired up, and that will get 100 times the spread of that investigation by Mother Jones. So there's a lot of things that are influencing what works on Facebook. A lot of it is just the absolute horrid psychology of your average person. But they are doing everything they can at Facebook to benefit it. And it's not just Facebook. This strategy of continually moving the goalposts on the right by whining about shadow bans and all of that, as they are continually dominating that most shared metric. And it's not just because they're whiny babies. Yes, they're whiny babies, but it's a strategy and it's working and it's been working for years. And I haven't seen anything from Mark Zuckerberg that tells me that they're going to be changing anytime soon.
No, and the fact that after all of this scandal, Zuckerberg is still at the helm of Facebook tells you that he absolutely signs off on every single strategy that they have. He absolutely has known what is going on. And he, so it's like at least have shame. Nah, the dude doesn't have shame. Yeah, no, there are, you know, Duterte is using Facebook to, you know, like repress his own people in the Philippines. You know, like there's like endless amounts of examples. You know, Brexit thanks to Facebook, Bannon, Cambridge Analytica. Like, when is it enough? Like, when do we get off of it? When do we realize it's a cesspool, y'all? It's the boomer parents. I know they're there. They're lovely. But we need something else. We need an alternative. And I absolutely think that if and when we have some reining in of big tech, or we have nationalizing Facebook, which may or may not ever happen. But I'm serious. I mean, I do hope that we live in a world and a time when like an actual free market of ideas, not monopolies, can emerge so that something else better and more concerned with your privacy and, you know, not 1984 in your brain could eventually emerge.
Yeah. A quick reminder, because we have a lot of other stuff we have to get to, but we talked about this back in August. A BuzzFeed expose talked to a Facebook employee about efforts to provide preferential treatment to right wingers. So you have the striking out algorithmically against, you know, the left. And then they had, you know, when Breitbart and Diamond Silk spread misinformation, the top level management at Facebook would step in to free their sites up from increased scrutiny, because we can't expect them to be honest, but we want them to still get reach. So we're going to step in every time they purposefully lie and we're going to protect them. That whistleblower was fired. So I mean, I don't know how much evidence we need. Facebook is literally one of the worst things humanity has created, unfortunately. It was just like 2 weeks ago that a bunch of domestic terrorists were foiled, thankfully, in their plot to kidnap and I would assume inevitably murder Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, that they don't like because she instituted lockdowns. And Donald Trump, who technically could be like so proud of the FBI for doing their job here, instead is continuing to instigate people to despise her for the same reasons that those terrorists did. Here is a weekend rally in Michigan where he is taking part, at least in a way, in a lock her up chant. about Gretchen Whitmer.
You got to get your governor to open up your state, okay? And get your schools open. Get your schools open. The schools have to be open, right? Lock them. Lock them all up.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, they wanted to kidnap and murder Gretchen Whitmer because she wouldn't open up the state. And so he goes to that state and yells at the crowd saying she's got to open up. And then they say to lock her up, sort of like kidnapping. And he says, yeah, lock them all up. Just lock them all up. She was narrowly avoided being murdered by terrorists. And he goes to the state to instigate further violence against her. It's an amazing country we live in.
Yep. This is the mob that he, I mean, that it's just, it's so, it, the mob mentality of hearing that, it's like it would be a funny Simpsons episode if it weren't reality. I mean, all of this is a great Simpsons episode. In fact, it was, but we have to live in it. And that's a whole different thing. And you see the way he's sort of delighted by, lock him up. Yeah, lock them all up, you know? And it didn't have to be this way. I'm just like, I feel like this is the moment where you're like, yeah, man, this is what the Republican Party hath wrought. Trump is what it hath wrought. These mobs of extremists, militias, white nationalists, everything in between, QAnon nut jobs. Y'all hath wrought that, okay, Republicans? Seriously, and there's an easy way not to. Which is, again, not that he's a great person or was a great person, but John McCain being like to the woman who said, oh, Obama's a Muslim, and he grabs the mic and he's like, okay, he is not a Muslim who wants to destroy America. He's not Muslim, he doesn't want to destroy America, whatever. Like, you can easily put an end to it and still be conservative. You could still be racist. You could still be like, you could still be all the things. But chanting lock her up or lock them all up.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, again, crossing the Rubicon here.
He could have, how many times have I said this during the pandemic? He could have taken this pandemic as an opportunity to actually be the strongman protector of America by taking it super seriously. And he could have gotten Democrats on his side. He could have gotten every Republican on his side. He could have gotten so much goodwill. He also could have saved, you know, 100,000 plus lives. That would have been cool too. He could have done all that. Instead, he decided to go the fascist strongman route of utter weakness and letting his people die in droves every single day. A weird choice. And inspiring more terrorism is just the cherry on the top of the fascist cake. I don't know. I don't know the metaphor anymore. I don't care about metaphors anymore. Our country is in the toilet, and Trump is sitting on that toilet. That's the issue. Now, here's the thing. Trump going to Michigan to inspire more hatred towards the governor who narrowly avoided being kidnapped and executed by insane people is bad news for Donald Trump. I mean that literally, it could be a bad news cycle. So I'm gonna argue this is why his own campaign tried to get out in front of it by asserting that, oh no, he's not a bad guy for inspiring terrorists to wanna kidnap Whitmer. Whitmer's actually the bad guy. Why? Get a load of this. So Gretchen Whitmer did an interview with Meet the Press, and in the background of the Meet the Press thing, she's got decorations, as we all do. We all are hoping to be raided by Room Raider and get a good rating. I didn't get one with my home studio. It makes me so mad to this day. But she had that little thing in the corner there. It says 8645. Do you know what that means? You probably do, but you're wrong. They'll tell you at the Trump campaign what it means, because they tweeted out, Governor Gretchen Whitmer displayed an 8645 sign during her TV appearance. 86 can be shorthand for killing someone. Whitmer's encouraging assassination attempts against President Trump just weeks after someone sent a ricin laced package to the White House. Okay, so that's not what that means. That's not what that means at all. Do we have any waiters, any hosts, any expediters, any short order cooks, anybody? In the audience, you know what 86 means. It means you're out of something or you need to get something out of something. Even Wikipedia knows this. 86 is American slang, which is used in the service of food and drink to indicate whether an item is no longer available or that an unwelcome customer should be ejected from service. Outside this context, the term is generally used with the meaning to get rid of someone or something, which makes 8645 sort of make sense. They want to get rid of 45. I don't think that Gretchen Whitmer is saying he should be assassinated. And if she was gonna do that, she wouldn't do it by putting something in the background that doesn't even mean that. That's a really bad way to inspire an assassination plot against the president. And Trump should know that since he's sort of inspiring assassination plots against her.
What he's doing there is he's justifying the assassination plots. I mean, and his team is justifying them. They're justifying the one that was there that was foiled, of which there's video of them running like target practice and all this ridiculousness. And they're justifying future attacks. Well, you were gonna assassinate me first, so I had to assassinate you. Pre-crime. Like what? You know, and so that's exactly what they're doing, and that's exactly what he's been doing. He's justifying all of this. I mean, I don't know what to chalk it up to, but I am like so horribly disgusted that after an attempt like that, that he and his campaign would still bark up this tree of violence. Like, leave it alone, bruh. Like, you're trying to get suburban women. Mm-hmm. This is like, you know, a middle-aged suburban woman governor in Michigan. Like, give it a rest. Like, we know you hate women, but like to this degree, do you have to triple down on how much you hate them? Yeah. So it's disgusting on all levels, and it's flabbergasting to think that this would be a winning strategy.
Yeah, I assume it can't be, right? Like, yeah, the red hats love it. They'll chant lock her up. They want everyone locked up. They don't even know who. Name a person, they want them locked up. I get that. But I don't think that that's the winning strategy for independents, let alone suburban women. I mean, Gretchen Whitmer is not for me politically, but I assume suburban women in general probably are predisposed to like her. She seems reasonable enough, right? It's his entire campaign strategy. There's an article in, I think it might be the New York Times. I don't remember exactly. Actually, maybe Maggie Haberman was one of the two bylines on it today. And it was about the disconnect between the Trump campaign that he wants and the Trump campaign that has any chance of catching him up.
Yes.
And this is exactly, he loves it. And why wouldn't he? This is the strategy that worked for him politically in the only area where he was a political genius. And that was beating other Republicans in a Republican presidential primary. He knew how to appeal to the sickest, most depraved, most racist people and stand out amongst a group of people who are all uniformly pretty depraved and sick and racist. That worked there. It's not necessarily a winning electoral strategy in a general election.
I mean, this is why he hasn't denounced or disavowed Q, because like Q is his only hope. Like getting more Americans to believe that there is some underground satanic pedophilia ring in the Democrats and that they're trying to stop Trump, the almighty all-seeing, like that's more believable than Trump being a good president. Like that, like you, if you, that's better for him. So like that's his only hope, is to create more nut jobs, create more, you know, Facebook, like Facebook dwelling folks who click on random Q stuff, than trying to sell the American people on actually doing a good job, whether it's on the economy, on the pandemic, on literally anything.
Yeah. Okay. I don't want it anymore. But it's not gonna stop because his rallies are just, hey, these like refugees and oh, lock her up. That's all it is, and it's sick. I don't like it. Over the weekend, Senator David Perdue had this to say about the vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris.
And Kamala, I don't know, whatever.
That was a joke. You get it? Cause like he can't say her name, and he thinks that the idea that you should be able to say the name of a woman who's been in national politics for years and is literally the vice presidential nominee, being able to say that would be ridiculous. And he's not the only one. We're gonna have some other examples. But Francesca, he's a senator. He's running right now. And he thinks it's funny that she has a name that isn't David or John or whatever.
Well, I mean, it's sad. It's mostly just sad. Like, good one, buddy. Like, you couldn't even like make a pun. You're just gonna mock her like we're in like third grade or whatever. Like, you know, you gotta level up if you're actually gonna like throw darts or something. Like, level up the puns or I don't know, figure something out. Like, sing Kamala Chameleon. That's what I was doing early on. I think that works. I'm not making fun of her. But yeah, I mean, it's low key racist. It's low key you know, against her Indian origin and ethnicity. What do you want? I mean, this is where we are. I do like this feels soft to me compared to everything else.
Yeah, that's true. I for me, it's just a reminder of the casual everyday nature of the racism. That audience wasn't appalled by that. They think, yeah, I don't want to have to learn that name. Give me a simple name. Like, no, if you can say Gregory, you can say Kamala. It's not difficult. It's basically the same thing. If you can say my last name, and admittedly, you probably can't because nobody can. If you can say Iderola with all of this mess of vowels, you can say Kamala. And if you can't, and if you can't learn that after months and months, I got news for you. Your biggest issue perhaps is not that you're racist. It's that you're a moron. It really, like, you are delighting in your own ignorance. That is a really sad thing. Like, the content also, is sad, I think the process is sad.
He should just follow up. I mean, I just like would have loved to follow up and like, just for the record, how many people here voted for Barack Hussein Obama? Yeah. Oh, a lot of y'all, two times? Cool. Just making sure, like, come on.
Yeah, if a random person who hasn't been paying attention to politics doesn't know exactly how her name is pronounced, okay, fine. But when they're corrected, how do they respond? That to me is the sign of being a decent human being. And not everybody can get it right. Let me give you a few examples of people who can't get it right. So a Purdue spokesperson pushed back on the interpretation that he was being racist about her name, saying Senator Purdue simply mispronounced Senator Harris's name. And he didn't mean anything by it. No, he didn't. He just mispronounced it. He mispronounced it multiple times. And then he said Kamala Lala Lala. That's joking about it. That's not simply anything. So not only was the response racist, he couldn't afterward, they couldn't just admit, I got it wrong. And honestly, I'm not trying to disrespect the senator, so I'm gonna pronounce it correctly in the future. But it's not just him. You might remember a couple months ago, in August, in fact, we talked about a Tucker Carlson segment where Richard Goodstein, who was on, said her name is pronounced comma, like the punctuation mark, la, Kamala. And he was saying this because Tucker Carlson had repeatedly mispronounced it.
Right.
He went on, seriously, I've heard every sort of bastardization of her name. That's where Tucker Carlson breaks in and says, okay, so what? And he was like really mad that he had been corrected. He didn't want to be corrected about the pronunciation because the point of his show, the point of watching his show is to feel good about being racist. And in fact, after that angry response, Tucker Carlson went immediately back to mispronouncing it because he's either really racist or aggressively stupid or possibly both. And so this unwillingness to learn is a layer of idiocy on top of the racist predilection. Anyway, you want the positive bit to this?
I do.
And that is, you do. I'm gonna give it to you. So Kamala, which by the way, like, I got issues politically with Kamala Harris. Kamala's a great name, isn't it? Like, it sounds nice. It's good sounds. And a lot of these names that aren't John or Jimmy or Joe Bob or anything actually are kind of beautiful, both in terms of the name and also what they mean. And thankfully, the hashtag my name is sprung up, where individuals who have names that are probably repeatedly mispronounced, sometimes intentionally to mock them with racist and xenophobic flavor, decided to explain what their names mean. So Ilhan Omar says, Ilham, I prefer Ilhan. I never like the M sound. It means inspiration in Arabic. My mother named me Ilham and inspired me to lead a life of service to others. In his honor, I am voting for an inspirational ticket over desperate and maddening one. So that's beautiful. Don't you love that?
That makes me like teary. That's like, you know, I think every time I hear about, you know, the squad's parents supporting them, I'm like, oh yeah, that's where it started. I love you. I love you, Ilhan's dad, for doing that.
During, was it bringing down the house?
God.
When AOC talks about her dad, I was just bawling. And like, I lost my dad too, so, but like, I was just done.
Yeah.
But Ilhan's not the only one. Rashida Tlaib says, my Palestinian father named me Rashida. I love it and it has a strong history in my family. It means righteous. That's right, righteous Rashida. I love that. Ro Khanna, friend of the show, says, Rohi, and my friends call me Ro. It means bright light in Sanskrit.
Aww.
Don't you just love, like, their names literally mean inspiration, bright light, righteous. Ayana Presley says her name means beautiful flower in Swahili. She told me, talking about her mother, she told me I'd make history and the world would learn how to say it right. And her mom was correct there. These are beautiful names with beautiful histories, beautiful meanings. You are not made lesser or worse by caring to learn this. That's a good thing. We're lucky that it's not just a million Sarahs and Jessicas and Johns and all of that. Those are good names too, and they have meanings. We mostly don't know what they mean.
Do you know, actually,
isn't it
do
nice
you know,
to have others?
I mean, like, I'm surprised that he's not, you know, embracing his own name's history, because Tucker in Gaelic means a pimple that's inside of your nose that you can't pop. It's the indoor nostril pimple. It's actually quite beautiful.
Okay, so what? So what?
Yeah, it's a tuker. Tuker. Yeah. Nose pimple, indoor nose pimple.
Can I give you a nose pimple? I'll give you a nose pimple. Let's go to our last video, because David Perdue and Tucker Carlson are not the only people that have a problem with this name. Donald Trump, admittedly a moron. This is his attempt at it.
By the way, you know who's further left than crazy Bernie? Kamala. Kamala. Kamala.
So that's three strikes and you're out. I think that's the rule. And he either doesn't know that, and she's literally running against him, or he does know that. And like, hey, everybody, hey, all my white fans. I know what her name is, but I'm not gonna say it because screw her. That's the message I get. And they love it. That's why they cheer for that stuff. They love purposefully mispronouncing people's names, because they think that by virtue of their birth, their name is better and more awesome than any name that came out of India or Taiwan. Literally name a place. It's better if your name is John, I guess. I don't, and we're supposed to pretend that it's not racist. It's just so obviously, casually, purposefully, stupidly, self-defeatingly racist.
It's so racist that you're like, if you put a mic in that crowd, you know, you're gonna be hearing a whole lot of epithets. You're gonna be hearing a whole lot worse than what Trump is saying on stage. Because the whole thing is still somehow hilariously coded. It's like, we're just gonna make fun of someone's name for being ethnic, and that's still kind of coded. We all know what you mean. Mm-hmm. And by the way, he's the president and actually can make good on his racism. So the border is, you know, the border wall is going up. What does Donald mean, you guys? Donald is actually, it's a Latin origin, and it means diaper rash. That is exactly, you know, just when you have a little too much chafing in there and, you know, just it gets itchy and it's diaper rash. That's a Donald. Ooh, I got
we
a little Donald.
Have experienced it. We're all experiencing it right now.
We've got this chafe.
You're really fast. That's good and disgusting. Thank you for that. Really fast. Hashtag my name is. Let's go through, because you've got their names: righteous, beautiful flower, bright light, inspiration. Do you know what John means? I remember this from when I was a kid. It means God is gracious in Hebrew. That's by the way, that is the meaning of so many names. So many names just basically mean good God thing. That's all it means.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. God stuff.
Do you know what Francesca means?
Yeah. I had to Google it.
You did? Okay, what does it mean?
It means amazing and like wonderful and like super funny and cool.
That's true. It's so perfectly appropriate for you. It is. No, apparently it means the Frenchman. It's an Italian name, but it means.
Oh, yeah. We, you know, it means Frenchman or like free man.
Yeah, that's good. I'll take that.
I'm not really
Freedom Prize. That's what it means. Freedom anyway. Prize, yeah. So yeah. Anyway, I like that it went in the direction. Great job with Ilhan and Rashida and Ro Khanna and Ayana and all of those for taking that direction. Anyway, we are way over. Francesca, the Frenchman, or beautiful, funny person, whatever it means. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, good steward of God.
The Lamb of God. That's what it
Lamb
means.
Lamb of God.
Where can we see more of your work?
Oh, yay. Follow me at Franny Fio on Twitter and Instagram. And please watch News Broke on AJ Plus and The Bituation Room as a podcast or on YouTube at Franny Fio as well.
Sounds good. Thank you. Have a good one.
Thanks, John. Take care.
America is supposed to be a democracy. I think that anyway. Senator Mike Lee might disagree. But despite the fact that we are supposed to be a democracy, one of the best, it is shockingly difficult for a lot of people to actually exercise their voting rights. And if you're a Black American, it is as difficult as the Republicans and occasionally the Democrats can make it be. And so joining us now, reporter who is crisscrossing the nation, breaking down all of the struggles, all of the opportunities, all of the debates. We're joined once again by Kenya Evelyn, breaking news reporter for Guardian USA. Kenya, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So I've really enjoyed your last few reports where you've been talking about some of these barriers and also some of the conversations being had about the Democratic Party, what they're actually offering. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of what you found with all these conversations you've been having?
Sure. Well, I think it's just stating the obvious that Black Americans have been disproportionately hit by what seems like three national crises at once. We're seeing of course, the coronavirus pandemic, and then that led to a national recession that Black Americans are, as we saw and as we are seeing, disproportionately impacted by. They're more likely to have been laid off. They're more likely to be frontline workers. And with that, then of course, with the killing of George Floyd in Minnesota, we saw racial justice and social justice protests erupt all across the country. And with that, then the backlash from white vigilantes and white supremacist groups. So Black Americans are feeling it at all angles. And so at the time that we're seeing Black Americans impacted by these crises, that makes them want to demand more of both Democrats and Republicans for their vote. We're just weeks ahead of the election. And so we traveled around the country, first at two places that were supposed to host national conventions. Milwaukee, Wisconsin was supposed to host the Democratic National Convention, and then briefly Charlotte, and then pivoting to Jacksonville due to the coronavirus pandemic. We went to Florida and Jacksonville, as well as Orlando, to talk with voters down there to see essentially how are these national crises, how are this unprecedented time impacting their vote. And what we saw in Milwaukee is that, you know, of course, as it's represented within the Democratic Party, there's an obvious generational divide between young Black progressives who want to see the party go lean more left and go more aggressive, be more bold in terms of bold policy initiatives and change toward progressive policies that oftentimes border on democratic socialism. And then they're oftentimes being met with resistance from their older, more moderate counterparts. And this is represented also as what we're seeing in the social justice movement on the streets in terms of who's taking out to the streets to protest versus those who think voting and solely politics and policy is going to institute change. And then contrast to that, we also saw in Florida where COVID-19 is impacting the fight for voting rights, as well as, you know, particularly with Amendment 4 voters, those who are returning citizens, or as we usually say, or previously used to say, those with former felony convictions, they're barred from voting. In fact, the Florida court just ruled that, you know, returning citizens will have to clear all court fees and restitution before they can cast their ballot. Another form of voter suppression. So Black Americans are feeling it all over the country, and that's essentially what we wanted to find out. How is that impacting their vote?
Okay, I want to touch on basically every part of that, but let's start with the last thing that you said, because you talked about the fact that the court ruled that they have to pay all of these fines, and it's very clear that this is effectively being designed as a last ditch poll tax, effectively. You also had recently Mike Bloomberg wanting to raise money to clear some of these fines. Apparently he has to raise it, he can't just pay for it, even though he's insanely wealthy. I don't really understand that. But do we know how many people are going to be freed up to vote? How much this effective poll tax is going to stop people from voting? Do we have any idea of those numbers?
That's the thing, it's essentially unclear. There are estimates that as many as 1.5 million returning citizens would be eligible to vote this election regardless of their restitution or court costs. But there's just no organization, no structure for it in the Florida system for a voter or for a returning citizen to be able to look up in one location where they owe you know, restitution or court fees in any given county. So it makes it very arduous just by design for voters to even, or returning citizens to access this information for them to be able to clear those debts. And so that's where we're seeing a lot of celebrity and political initiatives to help clear the restitution and court costs of those who may not even realize that they cannot vote. And that's what two of the people that we spoke with in our Black Voting Power series, that's what they were echoing, that this is all by design. The president is out, we're hearing Donald Trump say, you know, that there is massive voter fraud. And the idea is that if these returning citizens go to the polls believing that, you know, voting for Amendment 4 or voters voting in favor of Amendment 4 2 years ago freed them of the, or allowed them the ability to cast their vote, and then find out retroactively that they couldn't because they had a court cost or restitution, that plays into the idea that there was voter fraud because there are people just voting without knowing that they can't.
Yeah, let's stay on the access to the vote. So I believe it might have been in your most recent, on the 12th, I think, your article, you referenced and you talked a minute ago about how the pandemic has affected Black Americans far more than just Americans at large. I think you cite that 1 in 1,000 Black Americans have died as a result of the pandemic already. So a lot of people are scared of going to vote in person, especially day of, I think justifiably so. To that, if that's true, I think that Black Americans should be even more worried about voting in person. Has that come across in the conversations you've had, a fear that voting might be too dangerous? Is that affecting people's behavior?
Absolutely, in particular with voters in the Midwest, as we see the temperatures are already lowering in my hometown of Wisconsin. You know, October, November begins almost the winter season for us. And so that that allows the virus to be more susceptible for Black communities and frontline workers and other vulnerable groups to be more susceptible to contracting, both contracting and dying of the virus. And this makes people scared. This makes people fearful to even approach a voting in person. And what we saw with, you know, the electorate in Wisconsin is that the number of polling stations were reduced for Milwaukeeans to just 5 stations throughout the city. And that increased the risk for residents to contract the virus as there were long lines, sometimes stretching miles outside of polling stations. And so what we're seeing is an effort for Black Americans and voters all across the state to institute early voting or absentee voting, which are also issues there because, as we're hearing throughout the country, voters or absentee ballot applications for Black Americans are more likely to be rejected.
You know, I'm curious, obviously a lot of election law is state and local. It's not the federal government that determines everything that, you know, having to do with registration, early voting times and things like that. But you were referencing earlier, and I think you go into in depth in your work on of Florida, that there are these increasing demands on the Democrats to earn the vote effectively and to provide something in exchange for the vote afterward. Is there anything about aspirations that theoretically this time, if the Democrats control the White House, if they control the Senate again, as they did a number of years ago, that they'll take voting rights seriously and actually do something to enshrine those rights to the extent that they can federally? It doesn't seem like something the Democrats have really prioritized. They haven't seemed to have taken these voter suppression measures all that seriously in the past. Is that a thing that you've heard as a concern?
Absolutely. What we did see in terms of talking with voters is that they saw that, you know, Democrats oftentimes use them as a pawn, use them as a convenient voter block to visit churches, visit colleges, and pander to their communities when it's time for the election. But then the issues that impact them in terms of voter suppression, in terms of access to voting, those are issues that impact them offhand when we're not seeing a presidential election, when we're seeing midterms, when we're seeing them at the local and state level. And so Democrats have attempted to make these initiatives front and center for their campaign this time in terms of pushing for even what we see are the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which make voter registration automatic, which would increase the number of polling stations, which would make, you know, voter suppression and intimidation harsher punishments in terms of federal punishment. So what we're seeing is there are efforts to address voter suppression for Black Americans, but we're 3 weeks out from an election and Black Americans already more susceptible to a virus, already disproportionately impacted by a recession, and now targeted by white vigilante and supremacist groups on account of standing up for this very right to vote. They're seeing that it's a little too late. And so this is going to have to be an initiative that carries over long after Election Day.
You know, you mentioned this generational gap of what younger Black voters might disagree in terms of what they want in terms of policy versus some older Black voters. There was I don't know if you saw the town hall with Joe Biden last week, but there was a question. I don't know if the person asking the question considers themselves a progressive, but it got a little bit into that topic. And Joe Biden went on at length about wanting to stimulate wealth creation and things like that, which is fine. Much of his appeal in the ads I've seen and all of that seems to be a return to normalcy, vote for decency, vote for, it doesn't really seem grounded in very specific economic, healthcare, like those sorts of policies. Are you seeing that the way that he's trying to appeal, contrasting himself with Donald Trump, who is that working with and to what extent? Does it seem like a good strategy from the people you've talked to?
Well, it's a hit and miss. It is working with some demographics. It is working with some voters. Clearly, there are those who are former Republicans or former Trump voters who are disenchanted with the progress of this president and in terms of the rhetoric of this president. And so appealing to decency, appealing to just an old-fashioned, what we thought was bipartisan politics, you know, that appeals to certain voters, but that is not resonating with those who are saying, you know, even with returning to these times, let's also talk about the racial inequities that existed in this institution that we call the United States of America, that existed long before we're now seeing the presidency of Donald Trump. And so that isn't necessarily resonating. What we're seeing are younger, more progressive voters who want the party to go more bold, who want them to go lean more toward democratic socialism and policies that are going to address some of these longstanding institutional inequities that impact Black voters, as well as Latino voters, Asian voters, and what we're seeing are vulnerable groups all across the country. And so there's going to have to be a little bit more than a return to decency. There's going to be a need for bold progressive change in order to appeal to some of these progressive voters who right now are instituting their advocacy instead at the local level. We saw that in Milwaukee. We saw that in Jacksonville, where there are young progressives who are stepping forward to run for office, who are stepping forward to register voters to register residents to vote on the back end of, you know, filling out city civic surveys on how, you know, voters want to spend the city budget. So at the local level, activists are getting involved and they're demanding change and they're just waiting for the Democratic Party to catch up.
I couldn't agree more. And if anyone in the Democratic Party or the Biden campaign is watching, there's still a couple of weeks. You could still craft some ads, maybe put out a policy paper. There's still more that you could do. But Kenya, thank you once again for joining us. Really loving your work. Hopefully we can talk again before the election as you continue this very important reporting.
Again, thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.